that one. Well, looking forward to having Jim Hines speak today, and we'll get a more full introduction in a minute. And give you a little background on the number of members and so on. But just wanted to provide a little bit of context. If you've been following anything that I've written over the last decade, you know that I'm really passionate about rebuilding primary care in this country. It's become very clear to me that, having gone all over the country and all over the world to some extent, there's just simply no well-functioning healthcare system anywhere in the world not built on proper primary care. And we've absolutely destroyed primary care in the last 20, 30 years in this country. Thankfully, people like Jim are rebuilding it. And, it's important to recognize, because a lot of people just have forgotten what proper primary care is. I don't even know if you can call it primary care anymore when you can't get in for a week or two sometimes and you have 10-minute appointments. In a properly functioning primary care model, over 90% of the issues people come into the healthcare system for can be fully addressed. And some of the things that are in the news, like surprise bills and price gouging, and Marty McCary's book has brought a lot of attention to that. Well, it's impossible to price gouge on a procedure that didn't happen or an unnecessary imaging or whatever. And that's one of the important things. And if you look at, how is this done? I'm agnostic as to what works best. I mean, if swarms of synthetic biology built, AI-infused nanobots can provide great primary care, great. Show me the results. I just haven't seen that. And sometimes what I see people doing is putting Band-Aids on broken primary care because the bar is so low with primary care. Things like, standalone telehealth and, nurse care coordinators, things that generally proper primary care can do. And some of you may know that we have a link at the bottom of the page. My last book looked at the healthcare system through the lens of the opioid crisis. So I really dug in deep, because as I was on the focus on the employer issue, it became clear how big of an issue the opioid crisis was. And the sad reality is it's been employer-based plans that have kind of funded and fueled the opioid crisis, because most people impacted are working age people or their dependents. And in that book, I mention primary care over 150 times and the importance of it. And, unfortunately, if you're a fan of the opioid crisis, you're a fan of our undermined primary care. Nothing has created more fertile ground for the opioid crisis than our undermined primary care. And it's not to blame the primary care docs. They're as much a victim as any of this. And just give you one example, lower back pain and how badly we botch it in our typical healthcare system. Lower back pain is the second most common reason people go to the doctor after cold and flu. It's also the number one driver of disability, and it's the number one driver of opioid prescriptions, even though there's zero evidence that opioids are the most effective treatment for lower back pain. I draw the analogy with, if we were driving down the road in my car and it started making a terrible noise, I could crank up the volume on the radio and drown out that noise, but it doesn't fix the underlying problem. And so, the great primary care, like we're going to hear about in a moment, is the way, really the antidote. And I found, as I went back and studied the organizations that had proper primary care, bottom line, they didn't have an opioid problem. They would have 1/6 of the level of opioid prescriptions that a typical employer would have, even in settings where there was, physically demanding jobs. And I remind people, there's really three pillars of proper primary care. The one that people tend to think of with primary care today is acute issues, and certainly that's important. Two, and we're going to hear a fair bit about this from Jim in a minute, is kind of addressing lifestyle conditions that drives a lot of healthcare spending and kind of going upstream to that you know, preventable stuff. And then the third is when there is medically complex issues, you need to have somebody who is there as the point of continuity. You know, oftentimes if you have some medical complexity, multiple specialists are involved in hospitalizations. So it's really helpful to have all three of those things. And when you just use one simple example, because some people are like, gosh, you know, it costs money to invest in primary care. The good thing about when you have proper primary care, you can immediately avoid lots of unnecessary procedures and unnecessary ER visits. I mean, half of ER visits aren't emergent. They just can't get into primary care. And, you know, I gave an example in my book that's pretty stark and dramatic, but it's out there. You know, it was a 50-year-old Ohio woman who had started a new exercise program, and she had torn a muscle in her chest, but happened to be on the left side. And so she couldn't get a hold of her primary care doc. And so she was like, oh, maybe it's a heart attack or something like that. And so she went to the ER, and what, you know, the ER doc said, yes, yeah, certainly that's almost like totally likely to be a, you know, just a torn muscle, but you know, we have this new imaging equipment. Let's you know, just to be safe, let's run that. And like any imaging, you know, you can always find something. And so then they said, well, let's send you to the cath lab, you know, which probably should be renamed the cash lab. And while they were doing the catheterization, they perforated her aorta. And then when they did a graft to fix that, it rejected, and she ended up having to have her heart replaced. This is a true story. I mean, it sounds absurd, just all because she started a new exercise program. So of course that cost her employer a ton of money in the process, but that was the least of it. So with that introduction, I want to hand off the baton to Jim, give us a little bit of background on your union and the story. It's a great story, and this has been one of the fun things. I've kind of gone on the scavenger hunt over the last decade, finding the people who've already fixed healthcare. And so, Jim, why don't you go ahead and take it away?
All right. Thanks, Dave. So I am the administrator of the an organization called the Pipe Trade Services of Minnesota. We administer the health and pension benefits for a number of different unions of plumbers and pipe fitters throughout the state of Minnesota. There's approximately 5,000 active employees, about 2,500 retired employees, with a total population including dependents of about 18,000 individual lives. I've been the administrator for a long time, for 31 years I've been here, and we've always been self-insured and self-administered, designed benefits for our population. The unions sometimes have unique rules and situations, and so we've really tried to monitor that and provide the best benefits we can. But looking back a number of years ago, this goes back about 10 years ago, just watching the cost of healthcare go up and up and up, especially on the primary care side, and not necessarily seeing the value for that. The system changed over time and has continued to change the current primary care system to be one that is based on volumes and not necessarily outcomes. As a physician, the more you do, the more you get paid, regardless of the outcome. As a primary care physician, there are quotas in place of number of patients to be seen per day, per hour. The physicians that I'm hiring to come to work in our wellness centers, that's one of the things that they're looking for most, is an ability to spend time with their patients, to not have a quota, to not have every 15 minutes. And they'll use the phrase, and it makes sense from a business standpoint, when they talk about this. So we're going to have people work at the top of their license. So the physician is only going to do what the physician needs to do. And other people, we can have a nurse and a medical assistant and a referral specialist and all these other people in place. And that's what lends itself to the doctor spending a minute with a patient and trying to decipher what's going on and having a nurse and the referral specialist follow up. And I think that's the number one thing that is in the difference. I can talk a lot about the variety of things that we're doing here, But at the very tip of the iceberg is it allowing physicians to do what they were trained to do, to spend their time developing a trusted relationship with a patient, to have the time so the patient gets more than one question, gets an ability to have that discussion, gets an ability to get to know their doctor and have their doctor get to know them. That's what's making a difference, and that's what's changing lives. In looking at that a number of years ago, that's when I came up with the discussion and the idea of saying, you know, the system out there, we're not saying that anybody in the system is bad, but the system has developed and come to a system that isn't really focused on the patient. So what can we actually do about that? And having the forethought and being able to sit down with the board and discuss those ideas, we said, you know, we can run big health plans. We can run big pension funds. There's no reason we can't run primary care wellness centers for our members. And so we started the Pipe Trades Family Health and Wellness Centers. The name is very intentional. It is for Pipe Trades members. It is for their families as well. And it is focused on health and wellness. And so we had discussions about the best way to do that. We started small and scalable. This December 12th will be our 7th anniversary of having our own wellness centers. We have 4 different locations, and we have a whole variety of services being provided, which I'll talk about. It has been the most interesting thing that I've done in those 31 years. It has been the most rewarding thing that I've done in those 31 years to see the change that's happening when people have a primary care system that is focused on them as a patient. It really is making a difference. So back when we started, our 3 overarching, our main goals were to, number one, change the way that primary care is delivered. And there's a whole lot of things that fall underneath that title there. There's a lot of things we can say, but just to give a few of them, changing the way primary care is delivered. So the first one is for physicians, no quotas, no volume of patients that they need to see. They're not compensated on the number of patients they see. It doesn't enter into their realm at all. And it's interesting because physicians, when I'm hiring them, that's a question they keep coming back to. You're sure we're not going to have to do that? And I've never, in the 7 years, there's never been a quota given to a physician. You need to see more people during a day. I'd rather have them see 6 or 7 people in a day very well than 35 people halfway or a quarter of the way. They're able to take the medical history. They're able to build that trusted relationship. They're able to do research. They're able to do phone calls. They're able to do their charting. They don't have to bring charting home. That's all part of providing good care. And I also believe that if you give them that great place to work and to engage with their patients and not have them have to drag their work home at night, they're better at home. They're better at work. They're engaged in what they want to do is keep people well and make people well. So number one, again, a lot of things under that, but changing the way that primary care is delivered, changing that dynamic. Number two was to change the way we pay for care. So when our members come to our wellness centers, there's no copay, there's no deductible, there's no virtually no paperwork. I'll talk about the paperwork that there is. There is no billing system. I have a full electronic medical record, but there is no, I don't buy the billing module, no bills go out of the wellness center at all. In looking at that piece of it, we had to ask the question, what percentage of the current delivery system is spent on insurance and billing and other areas that are not directly related to the providing of the care? Now, it's necessary, but I will use the word necessary evil, and it's become too big a piece of the pie. Is it 1/3? I don't know what it is of the system, but it's a lot. And on the primary care side, it's even more. If you're getting a $50,000 heart procedure, the administrative cost as a percentage is not going to be that great. If you have a $150 or $180 office visit, I think there's $180 that follows it through the system from the primary care side to the people, to the wages, to the benefits, to the computer systems, to the programs for the computer systems, to the space, to the PPO, to the clearinghouse, to if it would come to my staff, I have IT staff and computers and people processing claims, sending out explanation of benefits, provider remittance, envelopes, postage. If you really put it all together, to chase after a $20 copay or a 10% co-insurance amount, what's the value of that in the whole system? So that was one of the reasons we just wanted to eliminate that. So all of our members pay a premium, and what we do is we just slice off a piece of that premium and use that to pay for the wellness centers. The wellness centers have a cost. We know what that cost is, and we pay for that cost for the premium without chasing money through the system. So in discussing that on the front end, one of the board members says, you know, people really are more engaged when they have some skin in the game. So let's at least have a $10 copay and they have something in the game, but it's cheaper than others. And in discussing it, we said, you know, that sounds like a good idea, but that is the microcosm of what's going on here. If one of our members were to come in and say, you know, I don't have 10 today, can you bill me? I need a person, I need time, I need an envelope, I need postage. You can see how we'd spend $10 or more collecting the 10. And that's what happens in those smaller bills. The amount of admin is just such a bigger percentage. So we just wanted to eliminate that. I do believe in the skin in the game. And one of the only, I said, we have limited paperwork. On a first visit, they only get one sheet of paper, the first one when they come in. And it is called the Health and Wellness Commitment. And it's a form that says, I understand my health is my greatest asset. It affects myself, my family, my friends, and my coworkers. And by accessing care with no monetary cost here, I commit to the following. And there's 9 things listed on that Health and Wellness Commitment. None of them are rocket science. It's about incorporating better nutrition and exercise into my daily life. I will establish a healthy and ongoing relationship with one of our primary care providers, which is a real big one for us because my workforce is 99% male. Plumbers and pipe fitters, construction workers, so they're not even just a regular male. They're a big, tough construction worker male. They don't need doctors, but we need to have them establish that to support their family and their health and wellness goals. Right down to 9 is about finding ways to create joy in life. Very holistic about the whole person. And so they look at that in the waiting room, sign that, bring it into the physician. And the physician, we set an hour of physician time for discussion at that first appointment. That's building that trusted relationship from the get-go. Taking a look at the commitment, asking where they're at in their health and wellness journey. How can we support that? It's about engaging with them and then empowering them. A physician can't do it for somebody, but we can help them and we can support them in any way we can. So taking that health and wellness commitment, talking to them about it, understanding what their needs are, taking their family history, rather than giving somebody a form in the lobby with 100 questions, have you or anyone in your immediate family had any one of the following conditions? That's not really the best way to take that history. It's to sit down and say, are your parents still alive? Oh, they're not. What age did they die at? From what? Do you have concerns about that? Anyone else in your family with that? You build that trust relationship while you build that health history. So changing the way we pay for care, we take away the copays, the deductibles, the billings, but we turn that around and try to engage them. But one of the biggest things about that no billing system is that the physicians are unencumbered by billing decisions. In the regular system, they have to think about when they are treating somebody, the billing system, and how do I bill for this? If I see somebody too long, I need to change and I need to bill for an intermediate visit versus an initial or short visit. They ask me questions. They are in here for their high blood pressure. I really can't talk to them about their other issue they're bringing up because that might change the billing. There's just a variety of things where they need to think about while they're in the treatment room. They need to think about billing decisions and documentation of that. And after that few minutes with the patients, there's a number of things that the physician themselves have to fill out paperwork-wise to do. Again, we really just, again, turn it on its head, and the physicians do not need to think about billing because there is no billing goes out of here. So there isn't a question about how do I bill for this? Is this what type of a visit? He's here for his blood pressure, but he's talking about his ankle. He thinks he needs a brace or he has earwax. It doesn't matter what it is. I have the ability as a physician to talk to them and work through whatever their issues are in partnership with them. So 1, changing the way primary care is delivered, with a whole lot of bullets underneath. 2, changing the way we pay for care. And 3 is to improve the health and lives of our members. That's really the biggest goal we have. We really want to operate with that true mindset of what is best for the patient. That's how we operate these. We provide convenient access to care. We really do have an emphasis on prevention. We really do want to support them in any way we can. And if you look at those 3 goals, none of those goals said, let's try to change the system to save money. It was changing the system for the better, for those providing the care, for those receiving the care, to really make it about that patient, to really make it holistic. And the most fascinating thing to me in this process is when proposing this to the board, I said, we're going to spend money up front, and we're going to spend money for 5 years before we start reaping the rewards of this, but we're going to, if we believe this, if we believe that 50% or greater of healthcare costs are related to lifestyle, this is the way to get after that. And it's going to take time for that. But I will tell you, to my amazement, we've had 7 consecutive years with no premium increase for a group of 18,000 individuals. That has never been the case in any of the other years that I've been here. So it's tremendous to me, the value that we can have by all those examples. Dave gave some great examples of the neck and back, or the low back pain being the number two reason that people go to the doctor, and the number one for disability, etc. Think about a male workforce of construction workers. Low back pain is a big thing. So we have on our staff, I have 4 full-time chiropractors, because I could see that my male members, patients were going to see in the health plan, going to see chiropractors, but not seeing primary care physicians. So we have chiropractors here, but the members are required to establish a relationship with a primary care physician, because we can't treat that neck or back in a vacuum. It might be related to something else. So they see the physician along with the chiropractor. We've added personal trainers in the clinic 5 days a week. So we really want to move upstream so we can get ahead of the game, rather than continually re-injuring your back or having those tweaks and coming in to get the treatment to keep you band-aided together. Can we move upstream and have you work with, we have a physical therapist, we have a number of personal trainers, and we have the chiropractor, then we have the physician, all working together, and we have a whole lot of other providers, which I'll talk about, but we really do emphasize the wellness team, that collaboration between providers that bring different skill sets to the table to help this patient, to do it in a way that doesn't happen anywhere else, where the paperwork is, again, papering a file and being done mostly for billing reasons and sent back and forth. Here, the chiropractor, the physician, and the personal trainer, and the patient can actually sit down together face to face. What's the plan? How are we doing? What's been the progress? What has worked? What hasn't worked? Etc. All those kind of things go together. So those overarching goals of changing the way primary care is delivered, changing the way we pay for care, and improving the health and lives of our members, we're at the get-go and are still at the forefront of what we try to do today. Lots of things fall under that, but we still promote that to the participants. It's in every single newsletter. We have it on our website. It really is a focus for what it is that we do. Couple other things is with regard to the wellness team. I mentioned the physician, and the physician's taking the time that they need with a patient being at the tip of the iceberg. And right along with that is this wellness team concept, people being able to bring their different skill sets and collaborate. In addition to, I mentioned chiropractors and personal trainers, we also have health coaches who are trained to assess people's readiness for change and to meet them where they're at and help them, be it diet, exercise, quitting smoking, whatever it might be. We also have mental and behavioral health and fully embedded in the clinics, in the wellness centers. And we have a full-time therapist at each site. We have a full-time, what's called a patient support specialist at each site. And we have 2 days of psychiatry at each site, a psychiatrist that rotates. And in my opinion, the mental and behavioral health is the most underserved area in that primary care system. There are still significant stigma issues with mental health. There are access issues, being able to access the mental health care as needed. There are, the ability to not only have to miss work for our members, if they don't work, they don't get paid, go to another provider, find that other provider, make a copay. I don't know who it is that I'm going. For our physicians to be able to be seeing somebody and walk them right next door and say, it might be helpful for you to talk to Dave. No additional paperwork, no additional time off of work, no copay, no deductible, no stigma. We call them coach therapists, a more positive term, trying to get at that stigma. We've been doing that since July of 18 fully with a team like that at every one of our sites. And we see more than 400 patients per month, or right around 400 patients per month for those mental and behavioral health visits. Those are visits that those people wouldn't be, most of those people, I'm going to say 50 of them might be seen, the other 350 wouldn't. They're not going to, there's too many barriers to that other care for them to go make that appointment and drive somewhere else and find somebody and fill out that paperwork. Being able to have a place that they feel safe and that they feel comfortable and that they don't have that paperwork and the copay and walk right next door. And so you can look at that and say, boy, that's an additional cost on the front end, but what is the value in that on the back end? What is the human value on that? Making that person better in their own skin, a better husband, a better father, a better worker, a better citizen, all those things wrapped together. Those visits that we're having, it doesn't have to be for the most major things. It is our recurring article in the newsletter is life happens. Things happen to us, and we might need somebody trained to help us with some coping skills and some tools to deal with the fact that my parents were both just killed in a car accident, or my teenage daughter or son is, I found out, is, you know, addicted to opioids, whatever it might be. Life happens, and we might need some help dealing with those. And so having that full care and that team, again, the MD and the physician and the physician and the mental health specialist, being able to discuss and work with the patient. There could be physical needs. It could be, I was newly diagnosed with diabetes and my father died from that when he was fairly young. That's going to be an issue that's going to have both physical and mental health situations. So can we work together on those? There's just a whole lot of wonderful things happening inside of here, and it's about changing the way that we deal with this primary care. And again, it's been really rewarding to see. So I think I maybe have talked long enough for right now, and I have other things to talk about, but see if Dave has any questions for me or if how we want to move forward.
Great. Thanks, Jim. That was really helpful. And you know, I think what Jim's organization's done is a great example of fully actualized primary care. You know, I'm aware they also have a vision center, you know, that's a great way to get family members in, and they have prescription drugs in there. So it's really fully thought out. One thing that we were talking about earlier, Jim, was with in the behavioral health area and Zoom particularly, if you could just kind of share that anecdote of the accessibility of therapists and, you know, how that's another thing that's removed a barrier. I think that would be an interesting story to tell.
Yeah. Just prior to the webinar here, as we were getting ready, I was talking to Dave and Ellen and Melissa about what a great tool Zoom is. We're all on this call today using Zoom. Well, there's a Zoom Medical that we're using for our visits, and especially on the mental and behavioral health side. Once somebody's been in and they've established care with one of our therapists or the psychiatrist, they've been using these telehealth visits to get some support ongoing and not have to do it by making a visit in. And what was very interesting is the psychiatrist, he says, you know, I'm kind of old school. I'm not sure if I'm interested in doing these video visits. But what's happened is he has done a 180 on that, is that people who have been being seen by the therapist and say, you know, there's this going on in my life and I feel like you need a support, they set up this video visit and they can do it from their home, which is their safe space, or they can leave work and go do it right on their phone in their car. And they have this interaction at a time when they need it, in a place that works for them and in a way that they might not have done it otherwise. And on the therapist or psychiatrist side, my psychiatrist was sharing with me, the one that said, I'm not sure I'm into this. He says, these are some of my best visits. He says, they're very intimate. He says, they're sitting there with their iPad or their phone, holding it right there. He goes, if I was sitting that close to them face to face, they'd tell me, this is a little strange. Why don't you back off? And he says, but no, here it's face to face. It's very intimate. It's very real. We've already had this personal established connection, and using those visits to support them where they're comfortable at the time they need it has really been a valuable tool.
Yeah, great. I love that story. Maybe share a little bit about some of the other things you do to engage the members, and particularly family members, you know, some of the touch points between visits and classes and some of that sort of thing, I think is also interesting.
Yeah, and that's an important piece, because even if someone has a medical condition and is coming to see the physician, and even on a regular basis, they might be coming in even on a monthly basis or every couple of weeks. But if you look at that, that still is only once a month or every couple of weeks. What do we do in between that time to support them? And so we have really focused a lot on a series of classes. And so we have, you know, yoga has been a very popular one. So yoga and meditation, we do that every single Monday night at multiple locations. We've done a kettlebell class. We do cooking classes that have been really popular with the family. And we title them all different things, you know, how to get the family out the door with a healthy breakfast in their belly, slow cooker meals with a healthy twist, shopping tour, going to a store for a tour, and then using the stores around here, have a room that we can use after touring it to sit down and talk about label reading and what do those things mean. we use something called CHIP, the Complete Health Improvement Program, which is a program that comes out of Vanderbilt University that we've adopted and adapted. It's members need to commit to 18 sessions to show up twice a week for 9 weeks for an hour and a half each time. And all of those classes have been, you know, invaluable. A new one we have this year called Healthy Living Club. One of our physicians does that each Wednesday from every other Wednesday from 4:30 to 6. And then we have a class, an exercise class right after. But those ways to engage them in healthy lifestyles and support them in that, where they don't have to pay for a gym membership to do that. They can bring their family along with. They're all geared towards families. So putting those type of things in place for support between the visits at the clinic has really made this something different. And we want them to come to the Wellness Center for more. And again, I'll use the word in discussion here, clinic often, but in print and in discussion with members, it's nothing but the Wellness Center, because we really want it to have that different feel that it's about health and it's about wellness. And we have a service here where they can get healthy meals pick up here. They get delivered. They're never frozen, never processed, soy-free, gluten-free, dairy-free, wild caught or free range, and they can pick up on Sundays and when or Monday mornings and Wednesdays. So they deliver twice a week, so everything is always fresh. Having the classes, doing those other things to support people rather than just having the physician visit has really been valuable. And we've been tracking, especially with the CHIP program, we do blood tests prior to and after. We look at amount of claims spent for the period before the class and after, and the results have been dramatic.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I mean, I'm friends with a woman who runs a kind of a healthy food delivery thing, and you know, they aren't in the medical field, but they started getting calls from doctors, you know, who were you know, had patients who'd had chronic, you know, diabetes or hypertension or whatever it might have been, and suddenly their health had dramatically improved, and they're like, geez, what's on? And they're like, oh, I get this box, and they're like, oh, what's in there? And it was just kind of, you know, that's the type of food you were just describing, nothing complicated, just real food.
Yeah.
And it's pretty amazing how much of a difference that can make.
Right.
One of the things that I wanted to emphasize, also make sure I get the data right, is you mentioned in several, you know, I think 7 years, you haven't had premium increases, which is great. You also mentioned that 99% of your members are male, and that can be challenging to get them in. And I believe that no premium increase happened, even though there's still a majority of your members who haven't established a relationship, you know, which obviously you're working on. But can be difficult with men, and particularly younger men. What roughly what percentage of your members have you been able to get into this program and still have that you know, result that you've had?
We're at about, just looking at some of those numbers, it's about 25% of our members that we're seeing. And you had mentioned the Vision Center. That was one of the reasons we put that in, was to, if you have this male workforce population, spouses oftentimes drive the healthcare decisions for the family. So if I have a young member at 22 who is then gets married, and the spouse has a primary care physician, that's who they go to. They have children, that's who they go to. You'll have to come back, please. Yeah, they won't be able to do it this week. I guess they don't understand. Please do not disturb and open this door. So anyways, that, you know, bringing them in, you know, spouses. So I wanted them to look, and when they get the newsletter, see, I can get my sports physical at no cost. I can get their immunizations at no cost. I can get their prescription drugs at no cost. Now I can get their glasses at no cost. I'm going to go in there. And once I get them in here once, and they see the facility, they meet the people, they understand that's a different process. And glasses are so tangible. It's something that people use every day. They've been through a process before, and if they have a better experience than the last one, and the cost was zero versus $200 out of pocket last time, whatever it is, it's one of those things that brings people in. So, and I'll just tell you, because I have another board meeting coming up, so I asked some of the physicians, give me some of your latest success stories here. And one of my female physicians, she had a great little blurb here, and where she said, a lot of our younger single males look to us like their mother hens. And we're here to help them figure some of this stuff out. And I just, that was just yesterday I got that from one of them. And I just thought that was a good quote.
Yeah, definitely. One of the kind of questions you put out there on the billing was, you know, what percentage goes to, chasing after, you know, particularly low dollar, but really all that. One of the things that I remind people that they're often surprised, or maybe just they're not reminding, I'm letting them know that I'll say, you know, healthcare isn't expensive. What's expensive is price gouging and administrative bloat and inappropriate care. And, the way in which organizations have the sort of results that we're talking about here, or even organizations that are, dropping their spending and because if you keep it flat, you know, every year, everybody else is going like this. Over time, they're spending 20, 30, 50% less than a typical union or employer. And what I let them know is clinicians, you know, presumably clinicians are the primary value creators in healthcare, the nurses, the doctors, all the folks you're talking about. They only get 25 cents of every dollar we spend on healthcare. So sure, there's some drug spending, but it's relatively small percentage. That's pretty dramatic. You know, you think about it, if you were donating money to a nonprofit and only 25% went to the core services or 30%, you would think that's pretty absurd. One of the chapters that I have in my book, which we'll put up a link for a free download, is in the real market, prices are flat. And that's sometimes surprising to people, you know, and what I call the real market is the direct contract and cash pay market. Because of the high deductible plans that so many people are on, that real market is actually very significant. And in that real market, for 5 to 10 years, prices haven't increased. Because of course, you talk to any doctor or nurse, their wages haven't gone up, you know, other than maybe with inflation. So that's part of how you do that. Through this journey, you know, what would you say were sort of a top pleasant surprise and maybe a top unpleasant? Maybe start with the unpleasant surprise through this journey as you've gone through it that sticks out with you.
The unpleasant side, one of the things is that's a very interesting stat you just gave, the 25 cents going to the doc, because every month we look through our financials here and I have a bar chart that shows our expenses, and almost all of our expenses are people. Almost everything is salaries for the physicians, the nurses, the chiropractors, the health coaches, almost everything. The prescription drugs, the medical supplies, the rent and phones, computers, that all pales in comparison. So I want to do that calculation for ourselves and see what percentage is spent on the docs. One of the difficult parts of this is that in human nature, resistance to change runs deep. It just really does. And so I'll talk about that in two ways. One level is with the patients, and that one is much easier than the others. That's a human nature. And if you treat people in a different way, that getting over that hump and getting members to change behavior, you have to stick to it and bring it in a variety of ways, but they'll do it. But looking at it from purely a business standpoint, so like many businesses, I have a board of directors and we review financials and we look at all these things together. And it has been a difficult concept to get people to understand that when we spend this money, it's really easy, it's tangible for them to look and say, how much are we spending to do this? And to see what the outcome is on the other side is more nebulous. You can't necessarily see that. And even after 7 years, and 7 years of no premium increase, and comparing it to their peers and not seeing that same kind of experience, I still have significant questions from certain stakeholders trying to prove the value of this. And looking at what that cost side is and just not really fully understanding the value. Not understanding that if I wasn't spending it here, I'd be spending it somewhere else. If a primary care visit, if someone comes here, it's not that they're not going to get that visit. They would get that somewhere else most likely. And then that other one, the member would wait an hour in the waiting room and spend a minute with the physician, and we could bill $200. And here, it's the flip side of that. And they're going to get, so what is the value of that hour-long visit versus the five-minute visit? I can't put my thumb on that like I can put on that I've spent $5 million or $6 million kind of a thing. So that is a continuous obstacle to try to prove the value, because in healthcare, and I've got software people working on it, we're running reports, but it is an ever-changing world. The size of your population, who's being seen, what is considered, what's the definition of a patient? What if someone who was seen twice? Is that a patient versus someone who was seen 12 times? What is the difference between those two patients? There's so many moving parts. So there is a difficulty. There has to be on the front end an understanding of everything we're talking about and the belief of what we're talking about, that lifestyle is really the only way to make big differences. The continuing to just get paid for the more you do with regardless of the outcome is just not going to be the way to attack these problems. So that's been a thing that's been out there for year over year. So that's been surprising to me, that even people who sit here and look at that they're just, and I just equate it to that resistance to change, the focus on, we've never done it that way before. Nobody else is doing it this way. Why, what makes us, you know, but they ignore the fact that nobody else has 7 years in a row with no premium increase as well. And so that's where I think the rubber meets the road, is it's hard for me to put my thumb on all those other pieces, but that piece I know, and that piece is different than others. On the pleasant surprise side is that us only seeing 25% of our people and still having that no increase and having that start literally immediately. That's the thing that's been honestly staggering to me, that because there's still, we still have someone getting a liver transplant, and I still have someone that gets a premature baby. But and I think for us, really some of the biggest things is that neck and back. You know, I've done some just basic reporting, not scientific blinded studies, but look, how much did I spend on neck and back last year, or the year before I had trainers and chiropractors, and how much did I spend the next year? And just simply something, everything with a neck and back diagnosis, I spent $3.5 million less 12 months after 12 months with putting trainers and chiropractors in place. So I have a cardiac specialist. You would think cardiac might be one that people would be really in tune to if their primary care physician says, you really need to go get this checked out. I hate to say half of my people won't do it, or won't do it immediately, or won't do it for the next year. It'll be in the back of their mind. But I have a cardiac specialist and that comes into clinics, and we know what day they're here. And if the primary care sees someone needs it, walk them into the room. The primary care physician, cardiac specialist, a cardiac and vein specialist, meet with the patient. It's tremendous. So the things that it is low hanging fruit with regard to lifestyle, diet, exercise, back, cardiac. Those are things that we can get at and get at very, you know, right from the get go. But it still has been surprising to me that us seeing not a majority of our patients, that we've been able to blunt the increase of the rest of the system.
Yeah. I mean, just a couple little factoids related to that. 2% of the entire U.S. economy is spent on non-evidence-based, non-value-add musculoskeletal procedures. Musculoskeletal is often the biggest single area of spend. Tremendous amounts of non-evidence-based care is happening there. You've obviously spoken to the things that do work, as I mentioned earlier, with lower back pain. You know, a typical status quo plan pays for things like opioids for lower back pain, and then doesn't pay or makes it difficult to access things like PT and chiro and so on. The other thing, just to add on to the sort of 25 cents of every dollar going to the primary value creators, the clinicians, the simple math is there's about 700,000 practicing docs fully burdened. They make about $250,000. The remaining 5.3 million clinicians, you know, 3 million of that are nurses. You know, if you add up them fully burdened, you know, roughly 100,000 fully burdened costs. That's probably even being, you know, conservative. That's how you get to those numbers. And again, when you strip away all the stuff that's like not healthcare, you know, I would imagine, you know, in your P&L, you know, that's probably more like 70-80% of your spend is probably the clinicians. So I know we've been getting some questions in, and we'll take a few of those. And if anybody has any questions, you can certainly, you know, use the QA box, and Melissa will share those with us. Maybe the last question I have would be, you know, are there any special considerations with a union versus a regular employer that you're aware of that people should be aware of? You know, there's various folks that will be watching this that may either work with unions or be union leaders. So I'd be interested in if there's any particular considerations there.
Yeah, and I think that there is. So we are the type of union that we have, or the type of plan we have, is called the Taft-Hartley Multi-Employer Health Fund. And one of the phrases out there is, if you've seen one Taft-Hartley Multi-Employer Health Fund, you've seen one Taft-Hartley Multi-Employer Health Fund. They are very unique. Unions are unique in that they have a culture, and that culture is different amongst unions. And it is it's a tight-knit group of people. And even in our industry, even though I have all pipe bridge unions, all plumbers and pipe bidders, six different unions, they each have their own culture. There's been a different leadership. They've been around for 100 years. I mean, each of our unions is more than 100 years old, and they have that culture. And so understanding that culture is a big thing. And those who, if the people are watching, if you're a consultant to that, you know, getting to who the leadership is and trying to understand that culture, and then saying, how do we work best with that culture? So in ours, one of the things that we talked about at the very beginning was leveraging the lifetime nature of our membership, because our members generally come in when they're young, and once they reach age 40, over 90% will die being a member of our plan still. They can work for multiple employers during their career. They can work here, there, or different employers. They can move around, but their benefits come to one central location. There's a portability kind of in those benefits, so it's really the union is the tie, not the employer. And so they come into that union when they're young, and they stay for their career. So we leverage that lifetime, you know, nature of their employment. Health and wellness, I think you can make the case in any arena, in any corporate America, in any company, I think health and wellness adds value. But I think we get even an extra bang for that buck because it is fathers and sons and brothers and sisters, and they come in when they're young and they stay. So we leverage that lifetime nature that they stay their whole career. We want to help them through their whole career. And the other thing we do is they have a sense of ownership. This is my union. I understand it. I'm proud of my skill set and what I have learned. They've always understood, I say better than the general public, that this is my health fund. This isn't big, bad insurance company. And, you know, I pay a huge premium, so I don't care how I use this. They know every year they get financials and it says, this year we took in $70 million, but we're going to spend 80. You have to put more money in or we're going to have to cut your benefits. There's no magic here. So they understood that. And so for them to have this year after year without having to put an increase in, they understand that. So leveraging that sense of ownership, it almost puts a self-imposed peer pressure of understanding I'm a part of the system. I'm a part of my own healthcare, but I'm also a part of the system. And being a good consumer, understanding it, taking charge of my healthcare, all those things that make a difference. So, you know, unions have their unique characteristics. We'll talk about having a different group, sometimes a little like herding cats. They all have their own things. But it's really no different than other places. And they have a strong culture, but understanding that culture and seeing how can we leverage it, how can we work with that culture to make these innovative changes acceptable, I think is no different than anything else. It's just really trying to making sure that you understand who that population is and how can we best work together.
Great. Thanks, Jim. Melissa, are there any questions we have before we wrap up the webinar?
Yeah, there's a question about network and whether you use a network, what network you use, what happens outside of the primary care context.
That's a great question. So we do have a network. Again, we've been, you know, the fund has been around since 1955. As I mentioned, I've been here for 31 years. We have always worked with the networks in town. Since starting the wellness centers, we still have, in each area is unique. In our area, we have three main providers. We have three big ones that each have more than a million or close to 2 million each members. They, a few smaller ones, but they really dominate. So we've always worked with one of those for our things outside of the wellness centers. We've worked with them before we had wellness centers, and now we use them for things. Again, we're not trying to be all things to all people. We are, as Dave kind of alluded to in his opening remarks, even if they need other care, we want to be the quarterback of that care. We want to get them to the right place for the right test at the right time. And so through before wellness centers, through the welfare fund, we had built relationships with who we thought were the best providers. So we might have had a broad network, but then I went out and found people that we had special relationships with. So one is an imaging center in town. I thought they had the best people, the best equipment, the best philosophy of not wanting to overscan and overtest. I mean, they have protocols in place to do it. I felt that they had a great system. So we had worked with them prior to even having our own wellness centers. So once we had the wellness centers, I bring them in to introduce them to all the physicians. They might have even known them before, but to really understand, we do a lunch and learn to come in and tell you who they are, and they become one of our partners in excellence. So we want to use them, and we put incentives. So for our members, our physicians know this, and the members, any scanning done there is paid at 100%. They're a good partner. We would prefer them to go there than elsewhere. So we've built that partner in excellence. There's a gastroenterology practice that we think is the premier one. So we built a relationship with them where they have put the colonoscopy prep kits in our wellness centers. And so if a patient's in here, my 52-year-old male is in here, and the doc says, you know, you really, because of these factors in your age, you should get a colonoscopy. By the way, here is your test kit. You don't need to go try to find these things at Walgreens or CVS. We're going to have someone outreach to you and set that appointment up. They reach out to them three times. If they never get it set up, they reach back to the primary care provider to say they never signed up. So the primary can get back with them and say, hey, I thought we talked about this. Would you like to get this done? Tell me what's going on. So we really have tried to build individual partners in excellence that we use that we think have an overall value add to the wellness centers. But with regard to the big network out there, we were with one of those big three for over 20 years, but as the wellness centers reached a certain size and scope, I did an RFP to all three of them, and I think that their networks and discounts and after 5 years would all be the same anyways. So the RFP was about, what's your value add to me? What can you do to enhance, you know, we really literally are trying to leave a system for primary care and develop our own. What can you do to enhance that and not detract? They all have. Every one of those big PPOs has a back program and has a early pregnancy program and has an XYZ program. Well, I think our low back program is going to be better, more hands-on, more team-based than theirs is. So don't promote that to us. We have that one covered. I don't have a high-risk pregnancy program. Yes, we want to use that. So how do we find out what we do best and what they do best? How can they really understand who we are? And things like they have an app on their phone where our members can get the app, or if they need care, or if someone needs care for the first time when they go in there, our wellness centers are always the first centers that come up. You know, things like that for them to promote us and work in partnership. So we have a huge network out there, but we've tried to find someone we could work closely with where we're still the quarterback of the care and we work together with them rather than care inside and care outside being completely separate.
Great. Any other questions, Melissa?
Yeah. So the next question is wanting some more detail about the flat premiums for 7 years. What that looks like for the members, what that looks like for your organization and their budget.
So in this realm, things work a little bit different than traditional insurance. So because the members can work for multiple employers, they could work for Al's Plumbing and Heating Company for 3 years, and then they take a job and work at the University of Minnesota as a maintenance plumber for 5 years, and then they move to an apartment being built and work for Joe's Plumbing and Heating. So they can move around. So the employers don't pay a monthly premium for each of them. We use an actuary. Milliman is our actuary. We look at our benefit set, and you look at your cost, and you come up with a premium. And then you take that premium and you divide it by a number of hours and come up with, there's an hourly contribution that is made by each of the members. So let's just say that hourly contribution is a round number, is $8 an hour, gets to $1,100 a month or $1,200 a month. That's the premium that goes in. Mechanically, how it works is the hourly contribution goes into a bucket that is their individual dollar bank. And then every month we draw out for what their premium is. So if they work lots of hours, half of our members have more than 2 years of coverage sitting in that. So if they get laid off or when they get to retirement, they won't have to pay a premium for 2 years. They have money built up. When someone's first starting out, it takes a while to build that up. So it's a different dynamic than elsewhere. But we do have a set premium every year. We have that actuary. They look at the benefit set. They look at our costs. We have monthly board meetings, look at our money in, money out every month, balance sheets and income statements and claims and high cost claimants and everything that an insurance company would do, but we are just that trust fund. We review it every single month. Every single year, we say, do we need premium increase or not? For what reason? We have active coverage, we have retired coverage, we have Medicare coverage. Those are different buckets. And so we just look at those financials. And so we do have a premium, and then we do back into how it gets paid for by each of the members. So in the past, what would happen is we'd look at the overall spend. The actuary would come up with a premium, say you need to have a 9% increase. And I would go to their union meetings and bring some high-level financials and say, here's what came in, and here's what went out, and here's what the actuary says we need. You need to all vote to say we're going to take 9% additional and put into our healthcare premium. Or, and if you don't do that, it's your choice. Then we come back and say we need to cut benefits. So our, there's no magic here. The amount of money coming in needs to pay for the benefits going out. And so it's very much like a traditional system in the fact that there is a premium, and that premium is looked at every year, and that premium is decided upon every year. It's just different in the way that it's paid for. It's an hourly contribution, and the members get to vote on it each year if they want to have a reduction in benefits, or they want to put in an amount of money to keep their benefits the same. And it's a fully comprehensive, that's medical, dental, vision, short-term disability, death benefits, retirement coverage, employee assistance programs, very, very rich coverage there. But they get to decide if they want to pay an increased premium or not. But on the and so what they do each year is in the contracts, they generally negotiate 3-year union contracts. They negotiate just a total package, and they're going to get a $2 an hour raise this year and $2.05 next year and $2.10 next year. There was times we had to go to them and say, we need 80 cents of that for healthcare, and we need 40 cents for your pension or whatever it might be. We've been able to, for 7 years, say we don't need any contribution increase. So it's kind of interesting. We have, every year there's about 200 new people coming in. So we've got 1,000 people that have never seen a healthcare increase. So it's brand new for them.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I think we're on the cusp of needing to wrap up. And so just wanted to add a couple comments. And Jim presented at our last Health Rosetta meeting and offered that it's okay if we share his presentation. So contact us if you want that. That sort of summarizes some of what Jim went through. And one thing that I really want to call out, it was great to hear about the mental and behavioral health issue. One of the things that was the core thesis of my last book, The Opioid Crisis Wake-Up Call, is that the opioid crisis is an anomaly. It is our healthcare system. And part of the evidence of that is benzos, which is the category of drugs for Xanax, Valium, very tied to mental behavioral health issues. It's pretty much tracking a decade behind the opioid crisis with, in terms of rates of addiction and overdose death, already 30% of opioid overdose deaths involve benzos. And so really credit to Jim's organization getting ahead of that and properly, giving people great care. So again, appreciate everybody's time today. And especially Jim sharing his story and the great work they've done and their relentless effort to continue to improve and expand on what they're doing. So thanks again, Jim, and thanks again, everybody, and hope you have a great rest of your Friday and terrific weekend. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks, everybody.
All right. Thank you.